This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hi, and welcome back to Money and Markets. This week, we bring you all the implications of that decision from the Bank of England last week to hold interest rates, from the market moves to the outlook for the housing market, to what it means for savers and homeowners. Danny Houston joins me.
Hi, Laura. We'll also be looking at a slew of data that gives insight into all our spending habits, particularly in the run-up to Christmas. And I'll look at the impact that's having on retailers. We'll also cover the big news that office space provider WeWork has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in the States. And our interview this week is on that very topic. It's all about UK property. Property investment trusts have had a tough time of late, but one vehicle doing much better than the rest is AEW UK REIT. So Dan Coatsworth talks to them about how they've achieved that.
Let's dive in then. Let's go to that interest rate decision first. So we had the news last week that the Bank of England had decided to hold interest rates for the second month in a row. The voting committee voted 6-3 to keep rates where they are, with the three dissenters wanting to raise rates to 5.5%. So it means that rates stay at 5.25% for another month, with the next meeting being mid-December, which is the last of the year. So the news actually provided a fairly decent boost for the market that's just about holding this week, isn't it, Danny?
It is, yes, Laura. Both the FTSE 100 and 250 are up since the start of the month. And of course, that decision by both the Bank of England and the US Federal Reserve to hold rate hikes once again. It's led to a lot of speculation that we might just be at peak rate hike. And the focus now is very much on when they might start to fall. Now, clearly, there is an awful lot that can happen between now and late spring. May is the time when markets are starting to expect that we will see rates begin to fall on both sides of the Atlantic. And last week, Dan was going through how October had been a really terrible month for stocks. So I think everyone's breathed a sigh of relief because there is now a degree of optimism, something for investors to grab onto, and sort of risk appetite has returned. It's certainly improved confidence. And when you look at performance since the start of the month, the FTSE 100's up almost 1.5%. The FTSE 250 is up almost 4%, the NASDAQ up more than 6%, and the S&P 500 up more than 4%. And it's interesting because November is typically a great month for the US stock market. In fact, since the 1950s, on average, it's been the strongest month of the year for stock market returns. And that's a point that's making headlines on business pages in the US right now. Now, still lots of ifs, buts and maybes. And it was really interesting at the weekend that two financial heavyweights, we had Jamie Dimon, the chairman of JP Morgan, and Larry Fink, the chief executive of BlackRock, both warning that geopolitical instability, the situation in the Middle East, is creating huge risk. But overall, optimism, and it has continued. And as I was saying, markets now thinking that we have reached peak interest rates. So I was saying a little bit earlier that markets sort of expecting May time, they might go down. Is that what you're seeing, Laura?
Yeah, we're not expecting any cuts to rates anytime soon. So what we're expecting it to be is flat until well into next year, with the potential for cutting after that. But I think what's important to point out here is it's not going to be your standard kind of peak and trough type mountain. If you think of a typical mountain that we think of climbing up and going back down again, we're not expecting that from interest rates, where we climb up to this peak and then rapidly drop back down again. We're thinking more of a tabletop mountain structure. So we've gone rapidly up, and then we're just going to sit at this flat point for a decent amount of time before the Bank of England starts cutting. And when they do come to cut, probably a much slower process and certainly not down to the lows that we've seen before. And I think it's also important to point out that these are kind of all market expectations. They're not what's baked in and what the Bank of England has said is categorically going to happen. We've got the potential for things like the conflict in the Middle East to push up oil prices, which will then feed through to inflation, for example, or perhaps some other of the economic data that comes through that's not as sound as the Bank of England wanted it to be. And all of those things could mean that they then move to another hike.
And if we are indeed at peak interest rates, what does that mean for people's personal finances? Let's start with savers, because this is something I am asked about a lot. They are finally getting decent rates, maybe not as much as some MPs think that they should be getting, but is it going to last?
So I think what we're seeing at the moment is that, yeah, potentially we're at peak interest rate, and we've actually already seen some drops in, if we look at the Best Buy tables, so those top rates that you can get, we've seen some drops in those. And so I think the news for anyone who's been waiting on the sidelines for even higher rates is to act now. Now is the time to lock in that fixed rate deal if you wanted to, or search around for that top easy access account if you've not already got one. But rising interest rates does mean that savers have shed that apathy that so many people have about switching bank accounts. And we've seen so many more savers vote with their feet, move to providers that are offering them better interest rates, locking in, so fixing up on those accounts to get higher rates. So it's been a great story for savers. However, we've still got a whopping £260 billion of savers' money sitting in accounts earning no interest. So this spark of savers moving around has been great, but it certainly hasn't touched everyone. Now, for some people, that's going to be short-term money that they've just left in their current account. But for others, that's going to represent a huge amount of lost interest on their savings that they could be generating if they shifted that money. So now is the time to move if you haven't already.
And what about mortgages? Because this has to be the most talked about thing at the moment.
100%. And it's become kind of like pub chat now, hasn't it? What's your mortgage rate? When are you coming to remortgage? What rates can you get? Bit of competitiveness out there on it. So I think the good news for homeowners who've yet to remortgage is that we're not expecting rates to go up from here. And actually, we might see them drop a little bit. What the market likes is a bit more certainty around the path for interest rates with the second month of holding and with these expectations that we're going to be at this level for a while. That brings a bit more certainty to markets, which affects the pricing of mortgages. So I would say no huge leaps upwards from here, some falls, but the downside is we're not expecting a dramatic drop in mortgage rates. So while they're not going to climb lows from here, mortgage rates still are far higher than they were when lots of people fixed 5 years ago or even 2 years ago. One thing that people have been doing is opting for a tracker mortgage. So we've seen these become far more popular. There was a boom in them after that ill-fated mini budget that has then continued. And I think the logic of this is people opting for a tracker mortgage in the hope that they can ride that out for a bit and then lock in once mortgage rates have fallen. The theory of that works. However, you need to think about whether further interest rate hikes are going to have a dramatic impact on your monthly repayments. If you're already on that tracker rate and you're at your limits of your affordability, then it's not likely to be the best option, because further interest rates hikes are going to push up those costs if they did materialize and make them unaffordable. So you really need to weigh up the security of having a fixed rate and knowing exactly what your payments are going to be each month versus maybe gambling that rates might fall, but you have the potential for paying those higher costs on that. But one thing that people definitely shouldn't do is go on to the standard variable rate, so often called the SVR, sometimes called the reversion rate. I don't know why they have to have so many different names for it, but this is the rate that you fall onto when you've come off of your fixed rate deal. And these have soared as interest rates have risen. So the average SVR has gone from 4.4% 2 years ago up to almost 8.2%. So a huge increase in that. And you think even if you fell on that for a couple of months, that would represent a massive increase in your monthly mortgage costs. So definitely, whichever route you take, whether you go for tracker or fixed rate, get ahead of when your current fixed deal is ending, get your finances organized, speak to a broker if that's the route you take, and definitely avoid going on that SVR at all costs if possible.
That is a huge difference. And I know that swap rates have been coming down, and I was talking about this morning, and an average two-year fixed rate has come down only a teeny tiny bit since we had that interest rate decision. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, people are just trying to figure out what is the best thing for them to do for their finances, whether it's worth sort of having that instability for a few months and then moving on to a fixed rate when they come down. And, you know, I think all the rhetoric at the moment is that hopefully they will come down, but they're not going to be anywhere near the level that they were. So people are just going to have to get used to it. But there is some optimism in the housing market, despite the fact that we have seen people really nervous about moving house, about buying a house, about getting their first foot on the property ladder and the expense associated with that. We have actually had house prices rising in October after 6 months of fall. So we had some numbers out from Halifax, which followed nationwide with a similar story. House prices up 1.1%. So that equates to about £3,000 on the average house price, now standing at £281,974. Now, if you look year on year, that's actually down 3.2%. And a lot of the reason for the fact that we've seen this increase is a little bit to do with the fact that maybe now we've got this pause to interest rates, people are feeling a little bit more confident, but mostly it's down to a lack of stock. So people have been really nervous about making a move, so they've not put a house on the market. We know that certainly house builders have pressed pause on a lot of their projects, but it is sort of creating a situation where house prices have sort of stopped their decline. And there was some interesting data out from Savills this morning, and it reckons that the average house price will rise by £45,000 by 2028. So no sort of pause, no sort of bottom dropping out of the housing market from what they can see. And we also had an update from house builder Persimmon just a couple of days ago, and that really did help to give a boost to house builder share prices. So it said in the 3 months to the start of November, it completed 1,439 new homes. Now, that's significantly fewer homes than the same period last year, where it was over 2,000. But it is in line with expectation. And just as we were talking about house prices there going up in October, it's seen the average selling price 2% higher at just under £297,000. It is always about supply and demand, and the housing market, despite the volatility with mortgages, we're still in a situation where I think demand is outstripping supply. And I think it is something which is going to be right in voters' minds whenever they start to get people coming to their doorstep to talk about the next election.
And we've had not one, not two, but three different bits of data out this week, which gives some insight into how the nation is spending, particularly as we're now, dare I say it, in the run-up to Christmas, which, as we know, is a crucial time for retailers. So first up, we had some new figures on grocery price inflation. So these are figures from Kantar, the research firm, and they actually had some very positive news for us. They showed inflation at the supermarket has dropped below double digits for the first time since July last year. So we've had 16 months of double-digit increases, and now we are back to single digits, but only just. So food inflation is at 9.7%, down from 11% the previous month. So good news that it's falling and that we've hit that crucial single figures level, but still a very chunky rise in prices. And actually, Kantar is saying that it's only seeing falls in prices in certain areas. They gave the example of butter, dried pasta and milk, to name a few. They also had some really interesting figures on shopping habits. So now more than a quarter of all sales come from promotions and offers, which is a huge increase on before and shows how people are really trying to make use of those multi-buy offers to really reduce their bill at the checkout. And people are spending far more on own brands rather than label names. But Kantar warns that might change as we go into Christmas. People tend to plump for brands. They want the quality, higher quality products or things that they know where they can rely on it. So they tend to plump for more brands. And Danny, I've got a great fact for you. I had you in mind when I unearthed this. The average price paid for a bottle of sparkling wine fell from £7.46 in August to £6.86 in October, which is news I will definitely cheer on.
Well, that is good news, but I have a fact for you as well, because the weather has seen wine production fall this year, which doesn't bode well, does it?
So we should stock up now. That is our unofficial advice. The second set of stats that we got about consumer spending habits is the Barclays consumer spending figures. So this is where Barclays amasses all of the spending data among its customers and gives us some real great insights into how people are spending. And the bottom line is that everyone is tightening their belts. So spending hit the lowest levels since September last year. There were some bright spots. So pubs and bars and clubs benefited from the Rugby World Cup as people went out and watched that. And we also saw people booking more holidays, which is always something I can get behind. And I think potentially spurred on by the bad weather that we're having at the moment, people are trying to book winter sun or their holiday for next year to look forward to. But people are cutting back. So ordering takeaways is one of the biggest areas where people are cutting back, and eating out at restaurants, but also buying new clothes and accessories for day-to-day wear. So some of those more luxury items rather than the essentials, we're seeing a huge number of people cutting back on. And I thought this was a great stat. 7 in 10 Brits say that they now take food and drink from home when having a day out to avoid paying for premium prices on site. So lots of people will have not long come off October half term. And that's the big trend that we saw during that period, is people taking their own food to cut the costs of a day out. But I think the big question that retailers will have is whether some of these habits will continue into the festive season. Will people still be shunning eating out at restaurants? Will people buy a new outfit for the work Christmas party, or will they wear something that they've already got? And in Barclaycard's polling of its customers, they found that, unsurprisingly, people expect Christmas this year to be more expensive than last year. But lots of people are getting ahead. Nearly 1 in 5 have already started buying gifts so that they can spread the cost. And 14% of people have spoken to loved ones about making a mutual agreement on cutting back on gift giving or not giving gifts already. So it looks like people are already looking at ways where they can make their budget stretch a bit further at Christmas. And feeding into that, Danny, we also had the important British Retail Consortium figures, didn't we? Which was our third of the three sets of figures. And they showed that people might be waiting for some bargains before they start their Christmas shopping in full.
Yeah, so we saw retail sales up by 2.5% in October, so still growing, but below the three-month average growth, which was 3.1%. And it does seem that, according to the BRC, people are delaying their spend. They're sort of hanging on till those Black Friday sales, because they've become a real sort of staple of the Christmas retail landscape. And when people are concerned about their budgets, they're doing all the things that you said earlier. They're having conversations with family and friends. We've just had a conversation with our next door neighbours, and we always buy them a gift. And this year we've said, you know what, let's just do cards. And I think there's an awful lot of that going on. But yeah, it does look like people are delaying their spending a little bit, spreading it out where they can, but delaying certainly the big items, because they're looking at potentially being able to grab a bargain. people spending a lot more on sort of lower price indulgences, the so-called lipstick effect. So beauty products and that kind of thing. A tiny, tiny bit of good news for fashion retailers, though, because, you know, we had that crazy October, 33 degrees. Was the temperature that London got to at the start of September, sorry, not October. And finally, in October, we had a bit of cold weather, which has helped boost fashion sales, particularly, you know, things like coats. Because frankly, back at the beginning of September, you really didn't need a coat or a jumper.
And so do we have any retailers updating this week that might kind of reflect some of those figures?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Laura, because we have had a whole load of retailers, big names this week. So one of the biggest on the high street, certainly one of the biggest in my house, is the Primark owner Associated British Foods. So obviously doesn't just do clothing and that kind of thing in its Primark stores, but also food as well. And it's seen its total revenue increase by 16% to 19.7 billion quid. That is in the year to September. Let's focus in on Primark, because that has done incredibly well. So what we've seen with Primark is they've got tie-ups with the likes of Rita Ora, which have really sort of tempted people into store. And sales have gone up by 15% to £9 billion. Now, it has hiked prices on some items, but it's been really selective in the prices that it's put up, because Primark is hyper aware that it occupies the value position within the retail landscape. And the best way for them to keep the tills ringing is to keep people coming through the doors. And if people, when they go into Primark, they're expecting decent value, if they don't get it, they're going to turn around, walk out, and then probably not come back. So it has seen that people, it says, have got used to having their budget squeezed, and they're now sort of making the most of what they have. So they've seen sales of things like Christmas jumpers, pajamas, and this year's must-have, the silver party outfit. Already selling particularly well.
I need to buy mine.
I was going to say, have you got your silver party outfit yet?
No, but I'll be going to Primark straight after this to step it up.
Well, another place that you could potentially go to, lots of people do seem to be going to, is M&S, Marks and Sparks. It has given its first update to the city since managing to jump back into the FTSE 100. It was relegated 4 years ago, had a really torrid time. And this is a serious turnaround story. So pre-tax profits were 325 million quid. That is a whopping 56.2% higher than a year earlier, and far higher than what analysts had penciled in. Now, M&S has really managed to deliver the sparkle when it comes to its food sales. And once again, we have seen that despite the fact people are cutting back, they see M&S as the place to go for a bit of luxury. And M&S has done brilliant things trying to sort of promote its value brands as well. So it offers certain things cheaper than you would find in supermarkets like Aldi. It really is trying to make sure that when you go in, you're not just going in to buy that little bit of naughty niceness, but you're actually able to do a shop while you're in there. But it's the clothing sales where it really struggled. When was the last time you went into M&S and bought an item of clothing from there, Laura?
So I don't actually go into shops anymore to buy things, but I did order some jeans from there only a couple of weeks ago. And I'm very happy with them, despite the fact that I still in my mind see M&S as somewhere that my mum shops. I've got to shed that, because they do have very good clothes.
Yeah, I mean, they've shortened their supply chain, so they're able to get stuff in to its stores far more quickly. So react to demand, to changing fashions. And its sales in clothing and home were up 5.5%. So it's been really interesting, because it was pointing to the fact that it has been hit by volatile weather, and there are all sorts of challenges and headwinds which could potentially impact sales in the months ahead. But so far, it reckons that there's been a lot of positive response to Christmas ranges and a lot of people making sure that they get in early to put in their Christmas food orders. Now, people, when they are thinking about Christmas and they're thinking about their budgets, are trying to figure out how to pay for it. And I know one area that Dan and I were talking about last week was buy now, pay later. A lot of people deciding to use the opportunity, because when you get to that checkout basket, particularly online, that's one of the first things that you're offered, the ability to put off paying for things then and there and to spread the cost over 3-6 months and not pay interest on that. And it is a great device as long as people use it properly. But I think a lot of people don't realize that it actually is debt. And there have been a lot of warnings about this and how it could impact people's finances, a lot of pressure on the government to deliver the regulation, which it is says that it is working on. But we had this week, Klarna, one of the big providers of buy now, pay later facilities, it reported its first quarterly profit in 4 years. It made 9.6 million quid. It's seen demand from shoppers boom ahead of the Christmas period. And it's had quite a tricky time, really. It saw its valuation drop considerably in 2018. It was profitably trading for a number of years since it was founded in 2005. But as consumer spending slowed, it did start to struggle. But it now says that potentially it could be listed on the market. And after having the valuation slashed to 5.4 billion from 37 billion, it now could list in London or New York for as much as 12 billion. So I think this is very much a sign of the times that it is incredibly easy to use buy now, pay later. Klarna has said that it is now looking very carefully at the people that it gives this facility to make sure that they can pay it back. Because, of course, if it doesn't pay that, that then comes as a cost to Klarna. But there are still a lot of warnings about the way that buy now, pay later is regulated.
Yeah, and I think the main thing for people to think of when they're coming to this Christmas is how they're using that debt. And if they know that they need to use debt, which lots of people end up using at Christmas, is to make a conscious decision about the cheapest way that you can get debt and the best option for you. And there's so much information online about the different options and different ways that you can do it. But I think it's so easy to just fall into clicking on that buy now, pay later button at the checkout without making a kind of active decision about taking on that debt and whether it's the best option for you. Now, I think another big bit of news this week that ends quite a long and sorry saga is the news that office company WeWork has filed for bankruptcy in the US. Now, we talked a lot on this podcast about WeWork when it was in its heyday, when the valuation was soaring and it had its subsequent fall after that terribly planned IPO. But Danny, what's happened here? What's the latest update?
Yeah, so it has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in both the United States and Canada. It sort of gives it cover to try and rearrange some of its leases and some of its debt. And you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a company which looked like it was going to be a stock market darling, heading for an IPO in 2019 valued at $47 billion. At the moment, based on its latest share price, it's worth less than $50 million, which just goes to show what the last few years have done to this business. Look, it's got over 700 leases around the world, over 30 different countries that it is in, and it grew hugely. And it's sort of got itself into these leases where they are fairly long term. So you're talking sort of around 15 years. So they're fairly inflexible. But at the same time, it was built on creating flexibility for its users. So it's now trying to renegotiate about $13 billion of its lease obligations, which clearly for some landlords, this is going to be something that they can deal with. And for other landlords, this, I think, is going to be quite a contentious issue. It's strange, isn't it? Because right about now, if you think about hybrid working, the way that everything has changed, this should be WeWork's big opportunity. But I think a lot of companies are looking at the fact that their staff are working more from home and cutting back on office space. And you also have this situation where what WeWork was providing, though, you know, the alcohol, the fun place to work, people are less interested in that. They just want a desk, and they only want the desk for maybe a few hours. So yeah, WeWork obviously now is trying to come out the other side as a leaner and meaner organization. But when you think about the potential that it had, the excitement that it generated, and the fact that it was the place for anyone who was on social media to be working out of for, you know, a number of years, it's a bit of a sorry saga that it is going through at the moment.
And I think it'll be interesting to see how SoftBank reacts to this, because they were obviously one of the huge backers and to a certain extent have pinned part of their reputation on WeWork's success, which clearly has not panned out. I mean, they've just made another debt for equity deal to try and kind of put some more life back into the company and more money back into the company while they try and navigate these debts. But I think it'll also be interesting to see what happens to Adam Neumann, who was the founder of WeWork and immortalized in various TV dramas, whether he comes back. He was ousted from the company after that failed IPO. He has issued a statement about the bankruptcy, and I wouldn't be surprised if we're not sitting here in a few weeks' time talking about him potentially making a bid for the company or getting involved again.
Incredibly colourful character. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, his exploits, which have been immortalised, as you say, on a number of television programmes, was almost the stuff of legends. But then, yeah, clearly 2019, as it was headed for IPO, lots of people deeply concerned about corporate governance and workplace culture.
So now to our interview for this week. So it's with property giant AEW. So with an 8% dividend yield and a performance that puts it at the top of the table for UK commercial property investment trusts, AEW UK REIT is proof that investing in shops, warehouses, cinemas and gyms can still be a good place to make money. Dan Coatsworth recently caught up with the trust portfolio manager, Laura Elkin, to find out why it's doing so well. So let's hear what she had to say.
So, Laura, the average share price total return for the UK commercial property investment trust sector over the last 12 months is about minus 11%. Yet AEW UK REITs managed to achieve a positive 20% approximate return. How have you managed to do that when seemingly most other property trusts are having a sort of a hard time?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. So speaking of our share price total return, and I'm going to just speak in terms of the figures of our average discount. So for AEW, our average discount to NAV of where the shares have traded has been over the last 12 months around 7%, which, of course, for most of the UK diversified REIT peer group has been significantly into double digits. So we have traded consistently at the narrowest discount of that peer group. And I believe that we're being recognised for having the highest performing property portfolio of that peer group. So in terms of NAV total return over 1, 3, and 5 years, we have delivered significantly the highest performance. And I hope that fact is widely recognised across the market and therefore translates into our better share rating. During the last few years, and I'm including the COVID-19 pandemic in that period, we have paid out from AEW also the most stable dividend of that REIT peer group. And again, I think that's reflected in the pricing. So it's that performance, it's the stable dividend, which I believe particularly a lot of retail holders will be holding our shares for. I think another point to just make here is over the last 12 months, we have provided to the market quite a lot of evidence of high conviction in our NAV. So we've completed 5 sales over the last 12 months, all of which have been at a premium to book value. And that has been in actually 3 market sectors. So in industrial, retail and offices, we have proven our NAV and achieved ratings above book value.
What are you trying to do as a sort of an investment strategy? Is it you buy sort of a cheap building, try and do it up and then sell it? Because I think a lot of people, if they're investing in like a property investment vehicle, it's, you know, that invests in an office block and they'll own it for the next 20 years and it's all about collecting the rent. Are you doing things a little bit differently then?
I wouldn't primarily describe us as a sort of buy, do up and sell strategy. Although, of course, if we see opportunity there, that is absolutely what we will do. And for example, we have some assets in our portfolio that we have held for many years and still have no plans to sell because they are simply delivering what you've just described, that steady income stream that supports our the company's earnings. I would personally define our strategy more in terms of how we buy assets. And I think that's where we set ourselves apart from our competitors. We look for mispriced assets.
So, I mean, are there lots of distressed sellers in the market at the moment then? Is this a sort of a once in a lifetime opportunity to buy cheap property?
We can find value assets to buy in the market through a whole range of different market conditions. And yes, that can often be through distressed sellers, but it doesn't have to be. Of course, we've seen a slightly strange dynamic going on in the commercial property investment market during the course of this year, with transaction volumes being very much depressed from their long-term average. Now, during that period, we have seen really all sorts of sellers of commercial property that we have taken advantage of with different purchases that we've made. And just to use an example, you know, we've seen some large open-ended funds who no doubt will be making their own thought, having their own thoughts on sales throughout the course of next year. But through the 12 months just gone, they were, for example, some of them selling out retail assets indiscriminately because they had chosen to exit that sector and were still enacting that strategy. Well, we see those types of decisions by other investors as opportunity because we can look through their holdings, and it might be that a lot of them we don't want to buy, but some of them we might want to buy if they sit in very strong locations, and we can take advantage of that if they have simply decided to sell them.
I mean, obviously you talk about retail. Now you've got, I was looking at your sort of portfolio. I see you've got a building that's leased by Next. Obviously that company's doing well, but equally you had some exposure to Wilko, which has obviously gone through a very difficult period. And I mean, what is retail sort of still quite a risky industry to put your money in, or actually are we seeing, you know, high streets a lot more healthier than, you know, post-COVID, the idea that we would all buy everything online is not proved to be correct, is it?
Yeah, I guess I'd to take that question in sort of various tranches. Yeah, during COVID, I think online retail sales peaked around 37%, and that has since fallen back down to late 20s. So yes, clearly proving the point that we do want to visit a physical shop for a number of different reasons. And that will always be part of how we shop as people. Now, I'm not suggesting at all that the retail market hasn't gone through significant structural change, because it has. I guess to look at the retail market as a whole and say, do we think it's good value or do we not think it's good value? Do we think it's too risky or not? I simply can't look at it that simply, which is why at AEW, we rarely ever take views on a sector as a whole. We look at all of our investment opportunities on very much, at least in the first instance, a bottom-up approach. And I would say that using that kind of methodology, we have very selectively found some very attractive opportunities in retail over the last 12 to 18 months, insofar as that four of our last acquisitions have been in retail or had a retail element to them. And I guess just picking up on those examples from our portfolio that you raised, that Next in Bromley. Now, we bought that for an initial yield of 8.7%. So first of all, an attractive income stream on day one. We know that Next as a tenant is healthy at a corporate level, but particularly of interest to us is how Next are performing from this asset. And when Next are known to trade very strongly from this unit in Bromley, they have a turnover linked rent, which clearly provides us with significant visibility on their trade, and they are trading ahead of their own expectations here. So we have that to provide a lot of comfort. So we have that day one income stream and we have a belief that it will continue. But even that is not enough for us. And what we looked at with this asset also was the fact that we were able to acquire it for a capital value of £100 per square foot. Now, in this location, that value is in line with residential land values. So we've got a day one income stream, a lot of comfort on how we think that's sustainable over the medium term. But over the long term, of course, things can change. And we've got that underwrite as well.
So obviously you got exposure to the industrial estates. Obviously on those sort of types of properties, you tend to find a mixture of large and small companies. Do you have any sort of tenants who are perhaps smaller businesses, and you know they might be at risk if we see potential economic downturn and interest rates are still quite high? You know, they could be struggling from high cost of borrowing. Is that something that sort of worries you?
Going through the times that we are at the moment, with certainly a lot of uncertainty out there in terms of economic outlook, it's not surprising that during those times there is perhaps just across the whole commercial property market an increase in tenant defaults and tenants struggling. What I would say in relation to our own portfolio is that, first of all, if we look back on the period of the pandemic, we managed to achieve in excess of 99% rent collection throughout each year of the pandemic and have done since. I can't really think of a greater test of our tenants' stability and resilience than that period. Of course, during that period, we saw a lot of retailer woes in the wider economy, and they have certainly slowed. But you've of course touched on Wilko in your previous question, and I'd just touch on that here too. We in our portfolio had some exposure to Wilko, and of course that they have now failed. And in the last quarter, we took quite a significant write off of their arrears and of their future income stream. During that period, though, we still managed to, in our wider portfolio, because of asset management gains, continue to show income growth, and will continue to do that going forward, I believe. So, yes, it's obviously disappointing to see a tenant failure, but where we have that asset in a high quality location, for us, it's located in central Bristol. I'm not concerned about the long term sort of void there that Wilko have created. Of course, it's disappointing to see them fail, but I believe we will fill that. Now, I think perhaps a lot of protection sort of from this risk comes back to diversification. And at AEW, we have always used diversification as a risk management tool. So making sure we don't have too much concentration in a single tenant or a single sector or in a single asset. And I think that leads us to being able to sort of weather situations like this, where of course, you know, you will always have instances crop up which are perhaps unforeseen. I would maybe just finish on that topic by saying that I can think of two instances in the last 5 years where we have seen the failure of an industrial tenant. And actually, because of that focus that I described with Next on how a unit itself is trading, both of those instances with tenant failure there in the industrial unit, led to that tenant being acquired by a Phoenix company who was actually stronger in terms of their parent company covenant strength than the tenant we'd had previously. Now, of course, because they had failed, that's almost inevitable. But we had some very strong parent companies acquiring these units, therefore led to accretion of value. And actually, we were able to sell both of those units at a profit because of that tenant administration. So there's a flip side to the coin. And if we're holding the right asset in the right location, then I believe there will, if we've done our homework right, be tenant demand at the end of the day.
Well, Laura Elkin from AEW UK REIT, thank you ever so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
That is all for this week. Laura and I have not been spending all of our time in pubs and clubs. We both do have a cold, so please excuse the fact that this episode has sounded just a little bit husky. Do join us next time when Dan and Laura will be delving into the investing prospects in India, and Tom Selby will be back with his Pensions Corner.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you whether certain investments are suitable or not. And don't forget that the value of investments can change, and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that tax rules apply, and that the way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.